Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about some southern rust and fungicide. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at the new Ag Climate Dashboard. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of southern rust. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Been another seemingly change in weather. We're starting to see some cooler weather in the future. So are we jumping right into fall, you think? Basically, we're going to get to the end of August and like, nope, done. All right, fall time. Let's go.
It does feel like since we've been such a greenhouse and hot and humid that even just the break to sort of quote-unquote normal feels very nice. Yeah, it's just got that fall. You know those mornings where you just get up and you feel that sort of Christmas? Can't say that. It sounds like I said Christmas.
Crispness.
Yes. In the air. It just feels like that. So you get that. The football weather maybe is what I feel like I term it to. I don't know if it's back to school weather to some people or if it's
the corn sweat's gone to corn dew.
Yeah.
A lot of dew.
It does. It's got like the sweaty mustache along the along the lip where it is very dewy now. Yes, a lot of corn dew.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't believe it's late August already. I mean, we get one more week, and then next Saturday is September 1st. Like tomorrow. But
Monday,
next Saturday,
Monday,
Labor
here.
Day.
Labor Day is the first?
Yeah.
Okay. Still, we're close. Like, we have a full week, basically, of August, and then we're done.
I feel like August gets gypped. It's like the Sunday of the month. Like,
it totally
Sunday
is
still the weekend, but by Sunday night, it's like you're back in.
Right, you know,
like,
Monday's coming.
Yeah, like, Friday night gets all the credit, and that's still a work day.
But, we had
like, late August, like, from August 15th on, it's just like, It's basically September. Like, summer's over, and it's really not. Like, there's still good days of summer to go, guys.
We had open house for school, and your wife has got in service, like, all these, you know, that my kids are like, oh, summer's over, when we told them we had open house this week, and they're like, oh, summer's over. And it's like, you got 2 weeks. You know, they just spent the last 3 days with our parents at the cottage, so they did a bunch of fishing and just...
Right, they're doing summer stuff.
Right.
Still, yes, it's the Sunday of the summer.
But now it's the, we got to get it all in, like we only have a week left of summer. Like,
that's true.
How am I going to binge whatever I want to watch? Or
It is all the summer plans you had, like, oh, we're going to do this, this, and this, and you start going, okay, now you got to... Especially in Wisconsin... Our summers are, in a way, so short that you got to really grasp each of those days and enjoy. Yeah. Like,
September is still really good.
Oh, September is the best.
Right. But the kids, you don't have free reign of every day, right?
Right.
Because you got school and it's back to routine.
But you've got tech schools have started.
Yep.
Kids are starting to migrate back to college. Like, it is kind of that time of year where you feel that push of, like, moving into the school phase.
There's a couple high schools in our area, Freedom and Amaro specifically, that have started high school already.
Cribbett's started as well because they have a
construction is the reason. Thing. Okay, yep. Yeah, and I didn't realize all the... Because you talk to people like, wait, why are they back in school? And yeah, well, they're going to be out early next summer so they'll have like a super long summer next year.
Ooh.
To do construction stuff on the school building. So yeah, that's got to be a wild way to sort of, at least you start earlier, but you know you get to be done earlier.
And I take my daughter back to college on Monday, so I mean, that you're right, Matt. Like, that's, football has started, so that's kind of like, we're over the hump, right? It's like this downhill slide in fall now because football started.
And it feels like football starts earlier every year too, but it just, like, even high school football, they have games in August, and when we were in school, like, I think they started practicing, but they didn't have games till school started.
Some of those last night. It was the first games.
Yeah.
Tonight's when, a big.
Bill, you've said now that they changed the rules too. They can practice earlier. Right?
They have more contact time. Yeah. Like, okay. Like they've kind of. I don't know exactly the rules, but they can practice and have contact with the kids throughout the summer now, which sucks because then it takes away from. Everything else, you know, like.
Well, even that, there used to be, especially for kids' sports, there used to be very, you know, you were, say, a three-sport athlete, and there was bumpers on either side of when that sport ended.
Those bumpers are officially gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no.
You're basically rolling into baseball, which seems to go later and later every year into summer.
Baseball basically just ended, right?
Yeah.
In general, for most.
Yep.
Now you're right into football.
Yeah.
So if you want to do those two sports, you have zero break.
Yeah, most of the kids that we deal with, like baseball ended we had a tournament the first weekend in August, and then 2 days later football started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like you get one day break of nothing.
So I can see why the kids are a little more panicked about school.
Yeah, true. That is true. Even like you say, even with sports, that with having no bumpers or no ending or starting, it's like they're always in.
Just
and even activities
other,
in
yeah.
general is like that. So,
well, and then there was the sweet smell of the porta potty that was outside the middle school last night. I don't know, Todd. If you,
I did not.
You got a whiff of that.
I did not. No.
Why was there?
They must have been doing some summer construction on something. I don't know if they were roofing or what, but there was right, like, not too far from the main entrance, there was just like a porta potty station, and it don't think it had been cleaned out in a while.
Did it have an out of
order aroma?
Did it have an out of order sign on it?
No. No, it didn't.
Should have, maybe.
Maybe.
Did you use it before you went in to open
it? No, I just walked by it. It was like you got that sniff of like, oh, yeah. That one's.
It's a good inviting back to school.
Yeah. So I joked with my son. I said, yep, that's your new school bathroom. They don't.
Yes.
Ones inside don't work. You guys have to come outside and use the porta potty.
Good luck in January.
How do all schools have like a smell that you, like that middle school still smells like it smelled when we went? And what'll be interesting is like all summer they ripped out the gymnasium floor. So like the whole, like it's got a whole new floor in it. And that flooring actually had that smell, and I thought maybe that's what made it that smell, or I don't know. It's just weird where...
It's probably a combination of, like, whatever cleaning products they use, like,
right.
materials in the school.
It's got to be something used every day, like...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like your, like, laundry detergent, how that...
You're
can...
slowly dying every time you take a sniff.
I don't know. Yeah.
It's just nostalgic for me. It's like, running the mile inside, which in middle school was, like, what? 25 laps. I don't know. It was a lot.
It was a lot in the school. Yes.
When you're in school, like it was nicer to go out to the track than it was like in the gym. It just felt like you were. It was so monotonous because you're just running around such a small area.
What's now? Kids worry about. We had the mile, and now God, I can't think of what they call it. Would they basically
monthly jog or whatever?
They do like those burner things, though. It's like
pacer test.
Pacer test. Thank you. The pacer test. And yeah, Bill's smiling.
Yeah.
Pacer test, because even when they hear that, there must be like a beeping noise.
Yeah.
So many laps, and it's just like...
Something about pace, like you're supposed to, I don't know, they'd be able to tell you better, but just basically, like it gets faster, so you're supposed to catch up to the pace, I don't know.
Yeah.
They just get mad about it.
Right, you're supposed to be at a certain pace or whatever.
Yeah.
Cause if you don't,
and then basically you can be out, right?
Right.
It's like if you don't hit, if you're not past a certain line by the time it beeps, you're out, which I think is just... I don't know when the pacer test was created, but yeah, when we grew up, it was the mile that was sort of dreaded. But at least you knew the distance you had to run, and
right.
you didn't pace yourself. You just ran as fast as you can.
Well, no, they kept track of your time. Like,
right,
you
right.
ran an 8-minute mile or whatever, 10-minute mile or 25-minute mile for some kids. I don't know. Heard some kids were going around messing with rearview mirrors, Todd. Did you have any experience with that?
Yeah, I'm sure it was kids. I got my truck to leave. And I went to look at my side mirrors to get out, and I knew like immediately. What like I, because they, I'm like, I didn't fold them in. I'm like, Matt, dang it! Like Matt says, it. Yeah.
It's like you just having a park right next to us, so
then, like
It's like the Wet Bandits.
Two of the kids with me. They were very confused. I didn't know. I just all of a sudden looked around. I was like, oh, Matt. And then
they didn't see Matt. What about Matt?
Right. And then, yeah, I jumped out and popped him back into place.
You didn't see it. I don't
have the button or anything. Sure.
So you didn't see it till you sat down?
Right. Right. Got in, went back out of the parking spot. And,
yeah. The guy who lives in the house right next to where you parked must have been really confused because he saw me do it. He didn't say anything.
That's great because that guy was out. Like, I got there and was on a telephone call for, like, 10 minutes just sitting there watching him grill corn.
Okay.
And he was kind of staring back at me awkwardly because I was on the Bluetooth. So, yes, he maybe was just – and then he did, like – while I was sitting there, he walked over, looked at the side of the vehicle, and walked back. I don't know the person, but, yes, that'd be even better if he saw you messing with it because he definitely was just confused by the
shenanigans going on in the.
Just in case you were some creeper, you wanted to make sure you knew what company name was on the side of the truck.
Talking to yourself in the truck.
In the truck, yes.
Sometimes I'll just put my phone up. If I'm on my Bluetooth and someone's coming up to me, I'll just fake put my phone up to my ear and be like, you know, like.
It is weird on the Bluetooth in the truck because, yeah, you're just.
You look like you're just talking to yourself.
Yeah, you just look crazy.
Which is, I still think better. There's people that walk around town.
Ooh, yeah.
With like on speakerphone and just like, so you hear both sides of the conversation when you're sitting outside. You're like,
Last week Friday, my son got his license. We were in the DMV.
Nice.
He's pumped.
The best day of a. Yep. I can't think of a better day in the life of, around, you know, say around, obviously, 16-year-old boy. That was, like, the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you can.
So now he can go wherever he wants. Yeah. He's excited. But the reason I brought it up is this old guy had, I don't think he knew he had his phone on speaker because it was an old flip phone, but he had it up to his ear and it was speaker and he was doing something with his insurance company. Like
just in the middle of the DMV.
He was at one of those tables filling out stuff, and he's like, oh, what's the claim number and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, bro, like, go somewhere else. Like, it was just funny because he had no concept of what he was doing.
That at least was unintentional. Like, even you go to the grocery store, and there's people, like, FaceTiming other people.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Walking through the whole store, like, having conversations, like,
I do feel like the advent of AirPods, like we had Bluetooth before AirPods, but now those two, there's.
And they're so good.
Right. That you see people just everywhere with them in their ear, either listen to music and then sometimes they'll be talking. Obviously, maybe it's to themselves. You wouldn't know. You can't tell
right,
somebody's
you know.
Crazy anymore.
They have an earpod in, then you assume they're talking to someone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm more referencing the people who don't go that step and just like feel like they need to broadcast both sides of the conversation to everyone. And it just kind of like it blows me away a little bit. And it is sometimes older people too. It's not like just younger. It's like these older people that are like, I just don't care anymore, I guess. But anyway, we're getting off topic. That never happens on this podcast. No,
never.
Never get on a tangent.
If we didn't even start the topic, we're technically not on a tangent.
True.
So
true.
The point of this whole tangent, though, is if your mirrors are screwed up, you know who did it.
Yes, it was.
Yes,
Matt. Mirror
I may
bandit.
Have been in the neighborhood.
Yes.
I thought it was funny that, like, did you? Because you got there a different time than your wife. Did you realize you guys had parked so close?
I saw her.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I saw her where she was parked. Yes. Okay. Did you? Were you? Matt the mirror bandit on her vehicle.
I didn't see her vehicle until I was leaving. I was like, and I wasn't going to like just jump out, like park in the street, jump out and do it.
Shut up. Then corn griller.
Then the guy grilling corn really would be like, what is going on? He's doing it to another vehicle.
There's no sticker on the side of that vehicle.
Yes. There's a warrant out for my arrest now for messing with people's rear view mirrors. All right, you guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yep.
So if you haven't heard, you're probably one of the lucky ones, but Southern Rust has been in the news. It's been talked about. You know, we've been getting calls, having conversations about this. So we thought it could be a good topic for the old podcast here. So if you're concerned about Southern Rust or you're just wondering what's going on, there's, you know, a few things to think about. It's a disease that's been around for a while. It's not new necessarily, but we don't always see it in a season. It's something that this year just happens to be showing up in more fields, moved its way from south to north. Imagine that, Southern Rust coming from the south.
Weird.
Can't imagine how that would work. But yeah, so a lot of questions about fungicide. You know, should I be doing fungicide? You know, is this something that I need to be worried about? You know, so my thoughts on this, and you guys can plug in wherever, but your options with this really depend on, first, the severity. Like, are you seeing it really bad? How bad is it? And if it's not that bad, you may not even be thinking about it because you haven't seen it or you haven't heard about it. But
one frustrating part about this particular disease is, and some diseases in general, there's not a good threshold established. So that gets to be a difficult part, is when we're using good IPM practices, a threshold is the first key to that. Have we exceeded a certain amount at a certain timing or stage? Then we can decide. This one, there's not technically an established threshold for it. One of the things I read said that if there is an established threshold, then just use about 50%. If it's 50% of the plants are infected or severity is 50%, it didn't really explain that part well. You know, that's a way to use it. But there technically isn't one, so that makes it really hard to make that choice of that right off the bat.
Right. So it's in the eye of the beholder. You might,
right.
One man's severe might be another man's, oh, this isn't so bad. But if you have it and you think it's worth considering treatment, there's some things to think about there is, okay, did you already spray fungicide? So like whether it was silage or grain corn, have you made that pass already? Because if you have, then you should have some protection out there. Chances are it was a fairly recent application. I mean, you probably did it within the last month or so, given the stage of corn that's out there. What stage is your corn in right now is another consideration. And we'll talk about, there's a chart that is out there from an article a few years ago on Southern Rust, and put out by the Crop Protection Network, and Damon Smith down at UW had reposted that because they've been getting a lot of calls on it too. As far as, you know, depending on where your corn is in growth stages, it may or may not be worthwhile to apply a fungicide. And the one that I think's on everybody's mind all year long, but definitely pertains to situations like this, is the crop going to be profitable anyway? You know, what's corn price at? Where is your yield expectation, your yield goals? And if it's silage, you know, how soon are you harvesting? What are your feed needs? How much do you need in terms of, you know, acres to chop and that kind of stuff? So when thinking about those things, first thing you probably want to think about is it even profitable to be spraying fungicide? Is it going to give me enough bang for my buck to make it worthwhile? So I did find Crop Protection Network has an ROI calculator when you guys and I were kind of looking through it before we recorded here.
I think this is a really cool tool.
Yeah.
We found Matt. Bill and I had not seen this particular tool. It does seem like tools like this, you know, where your ROI calculators in general, this has, you know, some sliders to change stuff and try to dial in, like, will I get a return? And this one seems to be good, helpful with a bunch of different products telling you some ideas. So, yeah, good find on this, man.
Yeah, so you can put in your disease severity, and it's basically just low or high. So there's no...
There is a spot
you could check. Do a custom. Yeah.
Yeah, to do a custom, and it was like 0 to 50%. So it has a few more kind of...
Yeah, you can
dial it in a little bit, but I think the low or high works just fine.
Yeah. You can put your expected yield in, commodity price, and then it has a default kind of cost, treatment cost built into the calculator, but you can change that too if you want to. So if you know, you talk to your dealer, your co-op, whoever, you know what your application cost is going to be, and it's different than what it defaults to, you can change that too.
I wonder if application cost is baked in this price, because it seems a little low that it doesn't have that in there, but I would think they'd be...
To me, it seemed... Yeah, I couldn't find if it was or not, so I thought that was an interesting... I thought it was interesting and helpful that they had prices in there to start with. It just makes it easier to start. But I agree with you, Bill, that I don't know, you know, especially when we're talking about getting a plane or a drone at this stage, you're not going to get to use a ground rig at this stage. In say you're using this at Tassel or right ahead of Tassel time, you could obviously use a ground rig much easier then. But I would agree that I think these are just talking about the product, not necessarily what you have with...
I think it is factoring in. So it says treatment costs are determined using product pricing and application costs from university extension specialists annually.
Good.
So I'm guessing it's more thinking of a ground rig. If it is including a cost, it's including ground rig, not plane or drone.
And I do, like, our local county agent was asking us agronomists a month or better ago about some pricing on fungicide, and I know he had to report back to Damon in Madison. So that would make sense that these are real numbers they're getting from people out in the field. So the numbers are probably pretty accurate, especially now that you found that it does include application costs.
Yep. So it says product and application costs are averaged in a national mean and median are determined for each product. So it's based on a national average. So somebody's getting it cheaper or more expensive than you, and they're trying to average it out. So you can, that's why you can adjust it, change it to whatever. But for the runs I did on it, I just left it kind of as a default just to kind of see where things would fall. And so I used $375 as a crop price. We had Auto Gaming Quantum Twilight meeting just recently, and that was kind of right around the neighborhood where it was looking at that time. And then I used $188 for expected yield, as that was the last USDA crop report.
Oh,
average yield.
I was just going to ask you where you got the one. Yeah.
Yep. That was what they were predicting the national average yield to be. And so I ran that. And so it tells you by fungicide, treatment cost, expected net benefit per acre, and your break even probability for each one.
I think that's the neatest part of the break-even probability. I've not seen on as many ROI calculators, and I like that a lot.
It's telling you it's a coin flip.
Right.
Right. Right. The highest was 56.7% break-even at that price and that yield. So your net benefit per acre, there's two that were positive. Everything else was in the negative.
What is nice about this calculator as well is there's explanations of how they get to this, and that's helpful because otherwise sometimes you just put it in the black box and they don't say how the black box told you what it got. And it says that how the break-even probabilities are calculated, thousands of simulations were performed to estimate the expected ROI of fungicide usage applications across a range of inputs used to calculate expected net benefits. The expected break-even probabilities represent the proportion of total simulations that had an expected net benefit of zero or greater, given a fungicide and set of crop characteristics. So it sounds to me, you know, this is almost like an AI type of generator. You know,
they're
running simulations and saying, like, out of these thousands of simulations, like in this case, you know, what did you say, 52% of the time.
It works every
break,
time.
You're going to break even.
But even if you, like, I upped it to $220 and a $4 price, there's still only 5 of the 12 that are positive, and one is 12 cents. So it's like, that's not. So you, even at that rate, there's 4 of 12 that are positive at a 48 to 55% probability of breaking even. That's still a coin flip.
Right. No, I upped it to 4, left the yield the same, and it gets slightly better. Then I did 5, and at 5, you had $5 corn. You had a lot more of a, you know, a lot more positive net benefits per acre. You get up to like a 60% in some cases, break-even probability. So price is going to have a big factor in this, you know, wherever price goes. And we know it can change as we get into fall, as the crop gets harvested. But, you know, if you think we're going to jump to five, that's probably a little bit wishful.
That is one, obviously, in any ROI, you got to look at what the crop price is at the time.
Right.
And any threshold. So that is helpful that we have to have moderate expectations because of the current corn price, too. It's just,
right,
we're not protecting as much dollars right now just because the corn price isn't good. So what is interesting is the same amount of disease, you know, a year or two from now, hopefully when the prices are better, and we'll see how long that takes. But it's going to be a different scenario whether you decide to spray or not.
And yeah. I think the conversation would be a lot different if it was a month ago.
Well, okay, correct. Right, I think, right, Matt's getting to that. Bill, yeah, is timing.
Right. Timing is important.
Timing matters.
Sorry, and, Matt.
Well, that's okay. It's all part of this conversation.
Timing matters.
Yes.
And you just jumped the time. But that's a good point, too, is this ROI calculator does not factor in the timing at all. You don't put a stage of corn into this.
Right. This is just based purely off of yield price
and disease severity.
Yep. So, but all right. So we're already starting at that point of like, so whether or not you pulled the trigger earlier and sprayed and didn't, it's already a coin flip, like you said, Bill, of profitability on fungicide just in general without taking in really any other factors besides price, yield, and severity of disease. And we were running those all on high disease severity. I don't know if we said that. So it's worst case scenario at the price. It's kind of a coin flip according to this calculator. All right, so now we look at stage. So if you've already sprayed fungicide, means you were probably at tassel R1, R2, somewhere in there when you sprayed. And like I said, it was probably sometime in the last month. We had a lot of tasseling corn happening in that period. So there was an article, and Damon Smith had recently retweeted this chart that talked about crop stage when southern rust is first detected, the possible benefits from spraying, and then they have comments like, you know, if you sprayed early, you were seeing it early, you sprayed early, do you maybe need to spray it again? So if it's a vegetative stage, you're not likely to find it, unless it's very late planted corn. At VT, there is a possible benefit from spraying, and you may need a second spray. If you're at R1 and you see it, then there is a possible benefit from spraying. Still might need a second spray. If you get to blister, R2, there's a benefit, and maybe not need a second spray. R3, so milk stage, which is
pretty much where we are right now.
Fair amount of corn right now is milk stage. It may benefit from spraying, but you wouldn't need to spray again, which makes sense the later you get. Now, dough stage, R4, that's where it becomes a maybe. So if you're starting to see dough in the kernels, then it's not as possible that you're going to see disease pressure. And if you've got some early maturity corn or some really early planted corn, and I've seen some corn, even some silage corn, that's already dented, as soon as you hit dent, it's unlikely that you're going to see any benefit. So if you've got dented corn or dough stage corn, it's probably not as worth it. Now, you know, if we already said it's a coin flip, just in general, the idea of fungicide. Now you get into the growth stage, and if you're late enough, it's really probably not going to. And if you hit black layer, then no, definitely not a benefit to spraying. So it's something that you got to really look at the stage of your corn, whether it's worth spraying. Have you already sprayed? Because if you've sprayed, like I said, there are cases where maybe a second spray is worth it, but the disease severity I don't know if what you guys have seen. I haven't seen anything like
catastrophic. Let's talk about what we've seen in the field. We've been at this 10 days now looking at
I would say we first saw ours, it was like early August. We saw one, and it was, when you first see it, I think one of the things to think about is it's so... It's so gross looking, actually, compared, you know, like tar spots, just black, Northern Cornelia, like this one.
Well, even common rust, which is
right,
looks similar in some ways. You never see it in the amount you do like a southern rust.
Right. And when scouts send you pictures of it, or when you get pictures of this one, it looks nasty. Mm-hmm. It just automatically is like, holy man, what is that?
Looks like shingles almost.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
You're right. The disease is inside you. Yeah.
You know that time.
Still have a shingles scar. It's so gross. Yeah, shingles is the worst. So you're right, Bill. I like the comparison to shingles, because it's just like, oh my God, like what are we doing? And it infects you're not seeing like every plant infected that bad. It infects certain plants really badly,
yep.
It seems. So like you say, that's when we maybe first started seeing it, and then it kind of wavered for a while, and then it feels like it blew up in our area that everybody started sort of getting concerned about blister stage corn.
But then there's plants that have one or two spots. Like,
right.
Like pustules, not like areas on the plant. It's just, okay, there's a leaf, and there's one speck. Okay, no big deal, right? And then you go to the, you know, walk 30 foot down the row, and you might find a plant that's, you know, got a dollar bill size area of disease on it. And you're like, that's when you're saying, Todd, it kind of looks gross. And then it's on the stalk too. You know, I've seen it plastered on the stalk as well. The good part is none of the fields that I've been looking at are above my waist within the canopy. Everything's well below the ear leaf, maybe a couple around the ear leaf, but I've really not seen anything above the ear in any sort of severity. So we're not affecting yet any photosynthesis above the ear where most of the sunlight's going to be catching at this point in the year. And I do have fields that we spray fungicide on a month ago that have southern rust.
It does seem, in general, the fungicides definitely helped. And maybe in your case, too, it seemed to keep the disease
way kept
to the lower
end of the canopy. Right. We're spraying with a plane or ground rig that we're getting the top half of the canopy. But when we're talking about the leaves at our ankles.
Right. Those are senescing anyway at times. They're just not needed as much anymore as what guys call like the flag leaves or the top leaves in corn. When you're scouting it, and Texas A&M has a good sort of reference to this, because severity to me on this disease is tricky, and we sort of talked about this, but I think it's that hard on this disease that it seems to show itself in different severities. And when you look at it, it doesn't look as bad. But basically, you say it, if you have sort of 3-5% of leaf area with it, which you wouldn't think, like 5% doesn't seem like it'd be a lot, but it's quite a lot of leaf area, you know, that has those pustules. And then you need at least 50% of the plants affected. You know, then it's starting to talk about spraying it.
So that's total leaf area or individual leaf? 5% of the total leaf area?
It's kind of more of an individual leaf.
Individual, okay. Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
but
right. So that's interesting too, Matt. You're like, well, 5% of the whole plant would be a lot.
Right.
But if it's 5% of an individual leaf, you know, and I'll show you, this is the picture they use for their 5%. You know,
that's 5%.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's.
I think that's the problem, like 50% is.
Well, and then 50% of the plants have to be affected.
Right. But 50% of leaf cover looks like all of
it. It's the whole leaf then.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
That's a good way to say it, Bill, is like 5% you would think looks like 50%
right.
to your eye.
And it's no different than the defoliation charts that
yes.
we've seen
those
with
with
like Japanese beetles or whatever, that soybean leaf that you see those stages and it's like 5% looks like 100%.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good way to say it too, is in the field, it's showing different. And then part of it's, if you did a fungicide, and then the other big part is how is the disease rating of the variety. So that's one thing to think about
too,
in all of this is, do you have a variety that is pretty good disease rating on Southern? Maybe you could not worry about fungicide as much, or you know it's going to have some of that natural ability to hold it back. But if you have a very susceptible variety, then you may have to consider fungicide at that point as well, or do using having a treatment or doing something different.
Yeah, so the overall, I guess, message here is don't immediately panic. Do some scouting, do some figuring, and look at it closely, whether it's growth stage, cost of application. Put all these things together and make sure you're making a good decision for your field and not just spending money that later you might regret spending in this case. And the other thing to consider, and I think, Todd, you looked this up, so you're pre-harvest on corn. So in a corn silage situation, you know, you're going to be harvesting soon anyway, so corn grain is you know, a different animal. You're going to be out in the field longer. But pre-harvest interval on corn, 21 to 30 days.
On most fungicides.
Just depends on the fungicide.
Yeah. Right.
You
check, yeah, whatever.
You'd want to spray. Doesn't mean you shouldn't forget about the rust in the field because you're not going to spray, but I think it should help you target harvest, right? Like,
right.
Look at those fields that are bad, and maybe those should be the ones that you take first.
Right. So, okay, I like where you're going with this, Bill, is on silage, if you're at R3, it's probably almost for sure is too late for your pre-harvest interval. You're not going to hit it.
Yep.
So then, Bill, you're right. Start using that as a tool. Like, okay, I know these varieties or these fields had it worse. Those are probably the ones I'm going to have to harvest, you know, 3 days early, 5 days. Who knows what it'll do with dry down. That is one thing with this disease on dry down. We don't know that part, how it's going to affect corn silage dry down as well. Like northern corn leaf blight, I've seen where that can, if that blows up at the right moment, can really affect it a lot. Tar spot, it affects it obviously, but not, it isn't like it tanks it. It just affects it and you got to watch it. I think that southern rust might be somewhere in the middle where obviously it's going to have a problem where you got drier leaves in spots that make a play in that whole plant moisture. I like what you said, man, about not panic. I like that a lot. Because I don't think this one is a full-out panic. We need to scout, watch for it, track it, apply as needed. And
yeah, this one's like any other, you know, situation in a field crop where we're looking for diseases anyway, whether it's northern corn leaf blight, tar spot, all these things. You know, it's August. It's getting to be later August. So especially for silage corn, we're seeing the light at the end of that tunnel. It's going to be here soon. And if you have grain corn, then that's probably a bigger consideration when it comes to a lot of these factors. You've got more time out in the field, more time for that disease to progress, and potentially more to gain from some sort of activity towards it. But regardless, you should be looking at the numbers and making sure it's going to make sense.
Well, let's face it, guys at this point don't want to spend much more money.
We don't have, right.
We don't, yeah.
Well, we're definitely in the fourth quarter, really in the last 5 minutes of the game, and I feel like we've been ahead on the, you know, we're ahead by two touchdowns, but they, you know, they just made a comeback, scored another touchdown, it's getting close, and we're going like, shoot, do we got to, you know, is it panic mode? Do we got to put our starters back in, or what are we doing here? Because we just, this disease makes you feel like we blew a lead that we had. And the one thing of what we're seeing is it's out there, but it's not in every field. It's a hard way to always quantify it, because it's in most fields.
It is there. Most fields, it's there.
But it's not a total panic thing.
No.
And then the weather, it likes 80 degrees and high humidity. And what are we doing this week? We're not 80 degrees anymore, and the humidity is starting to break.
Yeah.
So those two things will also help this corn. So one of the things with this disease, I think, was like Texas A&M, and Texas had a whole bunch of data on it. And I thought they summed it up well in that obviously it's Southern rust, so I'm sure in Texas they deal with it more. But they did say severe epidemics of this disease do not occur annually. Like for them, the last ones were 2012, 2007. Like it just is sporadic.
Yep.
And so what they said is the sporadic occurrence of this disease makes it difficult to get good data on hybrid susceptibility from variety trials. So it's also like we said, you look at the hybrid numbers and they may not be perfect either because the disease wasn't there or it was only there a certain time. So this one in general, I think that's what incorporates the panic is that part.
It's one we don't see very often.
Is it just not a thing that we have a problem with and can have a lot of years of remembering back. Oh yeah. We got Southern and we freaked out and it was fine. Like we don't have a recollection of that. So it makes it very hard.
All right, there you go. There's some things to consider as you're looking at Southern rust susceptibility in your crops. And if you should be considering any sort of action in regards to that. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So there's a new ag climate dashboard designed to help farmers make management decisions. A climatologist at the Midwest Regional Climate Center says their new weather-related tool could help improve the bottom line for farmers and ranchers. Austin Pearson said the Ag Climate Dashboard houses different digital tools that support various management strategies. What this dashboard is hoping to do is shed light on different areas that can help producers become more profitable, he said. Farmers can explore interactive tools for crop growth, pest forecasting, and risk evaluation. He tells us that the platform is designed by farmers for farmers. This is going to allow farmers to access up-to-date weather data, forecasts, and historical records. They can also discover new agricultural climate resources if farmers or advisors want to add a tool to the dashboard or a link to that dashboard, they can do it. Pearson also said that the project is funded by the United Soybean Board. And so it's purdue.edu/agclimatedashboard is where you can find more information on this one. And yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't know if either of you guys heard of this before or seen anything on it.
This has my favorite tool ever.
Yeah.
It has the corn GDU. So there used to be this website called Usable to Useful, and it's migrated to different places. And it looks like it ended up here now, which is great because I didn't know where it ended up. And they've got, you know, under products and tools, a GDU, corn GDU. They've got other ones even to the UW's GDU calculator. But the corn one they have is really helpful because it kind of maps out, you know, there's a lot of different buttons you can click.
Sure.
To make it basically help with when you're going to get a frost, you know, when if we're on the same 10-year trend, what does it look like? And so, yes, this is just in general too, looking at this website has a lot of good tools. It's interesting as we went from sort of this app, everything's on an app, and now
going back to web-based,
I think they're finding it's easier because you can still use it on your phone or on a computer. And going back to like web-based different dashboards, I guess they're calling it.
Yeah, you have to update less. Like you can update it whenever versus relying on someone to update their app or having to go back to it and be like, oh, you missed an update. You need to blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that takes off and works out. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So since we're talking about Southern rust, we thought we'd do a little history of Southern rust. So Buccinia pollisora is the causal agent of Southern corn rust. And yes, that is Italian. And it was first described and named in 1897. After it was first identified in 1891 on a specimen of eastern gramma grass in Alabama. However, in 1879, it had been observed that SCR was widespread in Central and South America, as well as being found in Massachusetts, which is much earlier than the first reported identification in 1891. The pathogen showed enormous destructive potential in maize or corn. It was later reported that the pathogen can infect several types of grasses. However, in the early days, they weren't aware of the particular causal agent at the time. So in 1949 and 1950, southern corn rust epidemics were reported in Sierra Leone, Liberia, Ivory Coast, Gold Coast, Togoland, Nigeria, in West Africa, resulting in 50% yield losses. By 1952, it had reached other parts of Africa, Tanganyika, Uganda, Kenya, and the eastern coast of Africa, where it was causing issues. Then it moved on to Asia, Australia. It was reported in Canada in 1954. In the year before, in 1953, it had caused 80 to 84% yield losses in the Philippines. First noticed in India in 1957. It emerged in Thailand in 1967. Then it was found in Hawaii that same year. And then there was an outbreak of SCR that extended to the main part of the Corn Belt in the United States during 1972 to 1974, which caused 30 to 50% yield losses. So when it was first found, yeah, you could see why there could be some issues, as yield losses seemed fairly high in the early days. But I think with genetics and other things over the years, we've definitely improved on those. So
the 1970s epidemic is wild. The old data on that, because basically there in 1970 there was like 16% of the U.S. corn crop was affected by it.
Sure,
because all of the prevalence of this Texas male sterile cytoplasm used in a lot of hybrids. So there was, if you remember back, it was a lack of diversity, or I don't know what you'd exactly call it, but that whole, basically, you know, there's a lot of literature on it. That's a lot of fun. We're not going to talk about that today, but this is the disease that caused that. So right. When we talk about that earlier, like we said, I like that you said, man, it's not anything new. 50 years ago, we went through a time where our genetics weren't, you know, basically.
Well, and all the fungicides we were spraying in the 70s, too, were probably.
Right. Who knows what those were able to do. Yeah.
If they were even doing any.
Right. So that's a fun rabbit hole on the internet to learn back about what we did wrong in the 1970s.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts, or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Like we just talked before, a lot of this is, you can just use your, just go to the web browser and go to tilthag.com/podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, with some current events. So, Cool Beans?
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week, $750, or $1 million, sorry, not $750. Texas fly facility is being constructed to help eradicate New World screwworm for good. So as part of a strategy that she referred to as the most sweeping actions in our country's history to date to combat New World screwworm, Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins announced that the U.S. will build a sterile fly production facility in Edinburgh, Texas. Ag Secretary shared the news during a press conference with Texas Governor Greg Abbott on Friday. It followed her announcement in June that the USDA would construct a sterile fly dispersal facility in that region. This production facility will triple our current output and eliminate our reliance on Panama and Mexico for sterile fly supply, putting America first, Rollins said. It's a tactical move that ensures we're prepared and not just reactive, which is to date what we have been working through. Federal government will invest up to $750 million on the production facility, which will be able to produce 300 million sterile flies per week. That 300 million additional sterile flies, in addition to what we're already producing in Panama and in Mexico, should allow us to eradicate and control this in the distant future, or through the distant future. So, yeah, be a good move, hopefully, to mitigate those issues in livestock. Our That's Corny this week. The National Corn Growers Association says Brazil's ethanol tariff burdens are harming U.S. commerce. President of the National Corn Growers Association said Brazil's 18% tariff on U.S. ethanol imports is unreasonable. Kenneth Hartman Jr. told Brownfield Ag News that Brazil was once a top market for U.S. ethanol producers. Tariff basically was a free fall of us selling ethanol into the Brazilian market. Just frustrated with this because obviously we've got a big crop coming on this season. Last month, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office announced a U.S. Section 301 investigation into Brazil's trading practices, specifically on ethanol. Hartman says the investigation allows the USTR to determine if a foreign country has taken unfair trade actions that burden or restrict U.S. commerce. So they're seeking a fair resolution and hope to see improvement on there. U.S. ethanol exports to Brazil have decreased from $761 million in 2018 to $53 million in 2024. So that's a pretty big drop.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. All right. Now we'll wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. The National FFA organization is growing membership and expanding student opportunities. The CEO of the National FFA organization says continued membership growth is helping expand opportunities for high school students. Scott Stump said that chapters in all 50 states are seeing a steady rise, with the largest jumps in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Florida. So state leaders are doing a tremendous job. He says our local teachers are doing incredible work, making a space where students feel like they can step in and belong, and they can ultimately engage to become the leader that we know they can be through the FFA experience. Said the organization is focused on developing programs where they aren't currently available. And they're really trying to make sure that the talent pipeline for the industry of agriculture, and he wants to work with communities that have an interest in offering agriculture education and FFA. So the National FFA organization is marking a milestone this year with more than 1 million members. So it's cool to see that we're seeing more interest, that there is a, you know, it's a growth in interest in agriculture in general and FFA. So very cool. I know you guys were both heavily involved in FFA in high school. So
cool that they hit a million. That's 1 million members. Like that.
1 million.
That's cool.
Mini me, stop helping FFA grow so much.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
I didn't know where I was going with that either.
A lot of ways you could have went.
Yes.
With that.
That was a good way you went.
Yes. Could have ended badly. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about Southern Rust fungicide and what to consider if you're thinking about making a fungicide application to combat it. In our spotlight, we looked at a new ag climate dashboard, which will help make management decisions. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of Southern Rust. Cool beans this week. The $750 million Texas fly facility will help eradicate screwworm larvae. And our That's Corny was Brazil's tariff burden on the U.S. commerce for ethanol trade. And our Field Good Friday, National FFA organization growing, marking a milestone of 1 million members this year. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.